So, I'm calling this talk The Power of Equanimity. I just released a podcast episode on it. And my hope is that you will come away from this talk determined to cultivate equanimity as a bodhisattva response to the state of our world. Anna, so I want to talk about true equanimity versus false equanimity, the power of equanimity, why it's important, and a little bit about how to cultivate equanimity. But just to kind of, I mean, in some ways, I don't think I need to convince anyone here that equanimity is important right now and sometimes hard to come by. But I did want to share a story experienced by one of our Sangha members that I'm probably not going to be able to relate without getting tearful. And I just ask that we all just kind of bear witness to this story. And then it is really going to, I think, frame our discussion of equanimity in a very visceral way. So one of our members in the Midwest volunteers at a community farm, organic farm, and over the years they've started programs for children and youth and high schoolers and young adults, and they end up with serving and providing food or discounted food, pay as you will, food to immigrants, and there's some immigrant volunteers. And recently, of course, because of federal budget cuts, their income has been cut by 55%. So they're already struggling. And then the farm has been subject to vandalism. And then the other day, the volunteers showed up and all 30 of their chickens and two of their goats had been shot. And I mean, this is just an example, right, of all of the suffering. I mean, the world has always had suffering. Always had suffering, but there is a lot to witness and absorb right now. So, a dictionary definition of equanimity is mental or emotional stability or composure, especially under tension or strain. And synonyms include calmness, equilibrium, self-possession, serenity, and even-mindedness. And this dictionary definition says, especially under tension or strain, but I would take out especially. I would argue that equanimity it only makes sense in the presence of what I'd like to call like conditional turbulence. If nothing's going on and everything's great, you don't really talk about somebody having equanimity, right? Equanimity is some kind of composure and even-mindedness in the presence of this. So in the teachings of the Buddha, the virtue of equanimity is considered very important and features in several important lists. So it's one of the Brahmaviharas, the sublime social attitudes, along with goodwill, compassion, and sympathetic joy. It's one of the seven factors of awakening. I don't have that list memorized. It's one of the 10 perfections or paramitas. So generally in Mahayana Buddhism, we have six, but in Theravadan Buddhism, they have 10, and it includes equanimity. And successful contemplative practice is described by the Buddha as having overcome covetousness and grief concerning the world. And the Buddha himself is described as the epitome of equanimity. So in the Pali Canon, Sakalika Sutta, it says, "Now, at that time, the Buddha's foot had been pierced by a stone sliver." You realize this is like way pre-antibiotic time. So this is like, this is an infected wound in his foot. "Excruciating were the bodily feelings that developed within him. Painful, fierce, sharp, racking, repellent, disagreeable. But he endured them, mindful, alert, and unperturbed. Having had his old outer robe folded in four and laid out, he lay down on his right side in the lion's posture, with one foot placed on top of the other, mindful and alert." So the lion's posture, when you see the pictures of the reclining Buddha, like as he's either passing away, it's like, you know, the head on the arm and the legs stacked. So it's a very, he's lying down, but it's a very mindful, deliberate posture. And the Buddha also faced alarming circumstances with equanimity. So according to another sutta, someone who resented him, Devadatta, his cousin, arranged to have a wild elephant given wine and released in the Buddha's path. So as the Buddha is going out on his alms round with his disciple Ananda, and the Devadatta says, basically, he tricks this king into doing it because he says, if the Buddha's really enlightened, he's going to know this is going to happen and he won't go out for his alms round. Mm-hmm. But the Buddha, of course, I mean, that, in these things, the Buddha does have powers, right? So the Buddha does know this is going to happen, but he goes out anyway. And so the elephant is charging him and Ananda. And the sutta says, "Standing close by the exalted one, and seeing the intoxicated elephant heads toward them, Ananda was so scared out of his wits that he stepped behind the Tathagata. That elephant, he warned the exalted one, is wicked and violent, impetuous, and given to creating havoc. It must by all means be avoided." Rather than running, however, the Buddha calmly stood and faced the elephant and ended up placating it. And it's true, the sutta says this, he does this using his supernatural powers, but I still think the, you know, the image is compelling of the Buddha, you know, standing boldly. So these are, you know, the ideals, the challenge of equanimity, of course. We find ourselves reacting. I mean, if we don't really care about something and it's not really threatening, you know, probably feel a fair amount of, you know, detachment about it. And other people may be getting upset about something, but we don't really care that much about it, right? So then we're very calm while they're upset. But then, you know, there are things which upset us, you know, like if somebody not only cuts you off in traffic, but it kind of like, you know, risks a collision. I mean, you know, we're going to be very upset if somebody, you know, assaults or we're a victim of injustice. That can be very, very agitating and upsetting. You know, loss or threat to the things that we love, to the people that we love, to the beings that we love. We have an emotional response. And when this happens, do we really want equanimity? It's a very interesting thing to contemplate. Do we really want to be equanimous? I mean, we'd like the benefits. We'd like to be seen as maintaining our composure, right? We'd like to be a person who doesn't, you know, lose it. So that's one thing, right? And we'd like to not, you know, get so caught up and confused that we can't respond effectively, right? And we'd like to not feel the pain of distress. But when we think about relinquishing our anger or our fear, our anxiety, we don't really want to do that, right? It kind of feels like those things are necessary, or a necessary response to keep us, you know, to keep us vigilant and to, you know, motivate us to protect ourselves or our loved ones or something like that, right? It's not, we want to kind of hold on. But then it gets, you know, all of this emotional turmoil gets exhausting and we want to break from it. So how do we do that? Certain ways that we manage to cope. And one, of course, is through denial, is through just trying to, you know, push away, avoid contact with whatever that conditional turbulence is. just not reading the news. Yeah. I mean, and sometimes we just have to do that, you know, for a break, to restore, to rest, whatever. But even if we manage to be quite happy in a sense, this is a very conditional equanimity, right? It's really based on not facing all of that. And so that's always a very tenuous thing, right? It's like that kind of stuff is always lurking out there. And I feel like that with the climate crisis, right? I feel like most of the time it's kind of like, la, 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 la. Like, I mean, you know, how do you face that? So sometimes we're just, denial seems like the only option. Sometimes we are just fixated on changing conditions, right? Like I'll be equanimous once that's addressed or fixed, right? And then, and that's essentially saying to ourselves, like, this is not a state that I can have unless the world gets fixed. And then we also might imagine that equanimity means indifference, that it means not feeling or caring. So if we're a victim of injustice, we would just feel no anger, as if we have no concern about our own well-being. Or if, you know, something bad is happening that might affect our family, we're not upset, as if we don't care about looking after our family. Or we lose something and we're just not troubled, as if that thing had never really mattered to us. We're scary circumstances and we just don't really care. Or we have physical pain and somehow if we manage to touch equanimity, that it would, like, physical pain, pleasure, neutral feelings, it would all be like the same. As if we don't have a human body, right? That which reacts very differently. So when we imagine equanimity means indifference, of not feeling or caring, I mean, there's probably more directions we can go, but two that I was thinking of was either dissociation or internally struggling with our emotional reactions. So dissociation can be mild or extreme, just disconnecting. And sometimes we just, you know, do that with a daydream, but then of course it can go from mild to extreme, where we really have just mentally compartmentalized, so that a whole section of ourselves, whole part of our mental structure, is just kind of cut off from our main consciousness. And this is not a healthy or long-term solution. The emotional responses don't go away. They just kind of sit there and maybe fester or build up. And then when we are vulnerable, they come on out. And the opposite is like this internal struggle, right? So we have these emotional responses. Despite all of our efforts, we flare up in anger. We stew in jealousy or self-pity. We sink into depression or despair. We get carried away by lust or greed, become paralyzed by anxiety or fear. And like, you know, and that got this great phrase from a book that we're studying in the practice intensive group, from Uchiyama Roshi. He says that you can make these things objects of hostility. We can make these emotional responses within ourselves objects of hostility, of like, either we shouldn't feel like this, or we try to argue ourselves out of feeling like this, and we try to, you know, suppress these reactions and responses. And it usually doesn't work all that well. So what if equanimity is not indifference? It's not a lack of feeling or caring. So if we go back to that Sakalika Sutta, where the Buddha is, you know, racked with pain and just, you know, so calm and equanimous, it does say that his the feelings he has are painful, fierce, sharp, racking, repellent, and disagreeable. I think they're repellent and disagreeable. Like he's feeling exactly what we would be feeling. Like, this is not a pleasant thing, right? This is like, ah. So he's feeling these full feelings, but calm. So the sutta continues, and Mara, the god of the desire realm, who doesn't want anybody to become enlightened because then they'll escape off into nirvana. So he comes by and taunts the Buddha, saying, "Are you lying there in a stupor or drunk on poetry? Are your goals so very few? All alone in a secluded lodging, what is this dreamer, this sleepy face?" So I read that as being like, Mara's essentially asking the Buddha, is this false equanimity, right? Is this either denial or indifference or dissociation, or, you know, all of these ways? Is he just, you know, suppressing his reactions? And the Buddha responds, "I lie here not in a stupor nor drunk on poetry. My goal attained, I am sorrow-free. All alone in a secluded lodging, I lie down with sympathy for all beings. I'm not awake with worry, nor afraid to sleep. Days and nights don't oppress me. I see no threat of decline in any world at all. That's why I sleep with sympathy for all beings." So there's a lot here. And, you know, so the Buddha lies there not in a stupor nor drunk on poetry. And I think of that as like, I mean, if I was in that much pain, I'd be like, give me some meds, give me some distractions, give me something to, like, you know, so that I don't have to focus on the pain. So he's saying, like, he's not doing that. My goal attained, I'm sorrow free. All alone in a secluded lodging, I lie down with sympathy for all beings. So, and if you can imagine experiencing that much distress and yet not your concern not being shrunk down to focus on yourself, but still, you know, maintaining an awareness and a sympathy for all beings. So it's an openness, right? It's an open-heartedness and an open-mindedness. I'm not awake with worry. And I mean, I don't know what the Buddha really meant, but I think of that as like, if I was laying there, you know, on my side, I'm in a lot of pain and I'm trying to have equanimity, I'd be kind of like, I mean, there'd be an effort, right? I'd be trying to be equanimous, right? I'd be like, so he's, in a way he's saying, I'm not awake with, you know, this great effort to not be distressed. Nor is he afraid to sleep. Nor is he afraid to, like, give up conscious control. Like, this isn't about a conscious control of his reactions. Days and nights don't oppress me. I just think about, you know, how long nights would feel if you were in that much pain, right? And how miserable and horrible and dark and depressing and yet it's like, okay, you know, day, night, pain, relief of pain, you know, a certain ease, a certain misery, like, yeah, comes and goes, but it doesn't oppress if you're not wishing for your experience to be other than what it is. And this is really interesting. I see no threat of decline in any world at all. I mean, this is a kind of about an enlightened perspective of there's the two sides of reality. There's the relative or the dependent dimension side where there is suffering and injustice and karma and, you know, action and response. And then there is also the absolute or independent dimension where, in a sense, you know, right here, right now, any concept we make about the world or the way that the world should be, right or wrong or good or bad, is an abstraction. Now, both sides are true. It's not that therefore the absolute is true and there is no suffering. But when we can really hold both, we recognize that all of the stories that we tell about disaster or injustice are that. And it I don't know, it makes them less, we're less trapped by those stories, which we might still want to tell, right, in the relative world. That's why I sleep with sympathy for all beings. So not only does he have sympathy for all beings when he's like wide awake, even when he's sleeping, he has sympathy for all beings. So cultivating equanimity. This happens through our practice, slowly but surely, at many different levels. I mean, at the very basic level, as soon as we start sitting or being mindful, we recognize that thoughts and feelings come and go, and we become more identified with the space through which everything moves and less with the content. You know, that whole like, I am angry versus angry feelings are arising in me right now, right? It's a bigger perspective. And so we tend to be just a little bit less upset. We work on our karma. We work on those, you know, our kind of deluded and unhealthy ways of looking at things. And when we're able to kind of let them go, it eases a lot of that distress and suffering. Insight, you know, like into the dependent and independent dimensions, and a sense in which everything right now at this moment is complete. But equanimity isn't something that we gain and keep. So I was thinking of it as kind of like physical balance while moving and living, right? Because like there's I think it's very natural for us to be like, okay, you know, I have this amount of understanding, this amount of practice, feeling some equanimity. Like, yeah, I got it now. Like it's something that we can attain and stay in. But that's like, you know, if you thought about physical balance, if you were just standing, you'd be like, yeah, I'm balanced now. I mean, once you move, once you respond to things, the balance only really matters in that movement and response. So equanimity is something that like we seek in every moment, in every responding to every situation. And this is what I like. If you lose it, you just get it back, right? Like it's not like a terrible sin or a sign of weakness, right? It's like some stuff is going to happen to us and we're going to lose it. And then as soon as we can, we just, you know, get our balance back. And it's not about a set of beliefs, like a positive worldview, which is also very tempting, right? Because like the Buddhist kind of worldview is kind of nice, you know, even with the like absolute and relative, and in a certain sense, everything is precious just as it is. And if I can just kind of maintain this worldview, I won't be as bothered by everything. But again, that's just the view is helpful only in the way that it changes your perception of like this moment, right? And so it matters a lot. Your view, you might, you know, a challenge might come at you and you meet it very differently now than you did maybe 10 years ago, right? But it's not really about the view at that moment. It's the view is just kind of setting the stage. But in the moment, it's not about a positive worldview. Which, I mean, I kind of confess to a little bit of a wish or longing that the Buddha or enlightened beings, or if I'm enlightened someday, I'll just like, it'll all make sense, you know? And in climate change, I'll be like, I'll understand how it's all going to work out. Or I'm going to understand how it's all okay if it doesn't. You know, like I could have a perspective from which nothing is upsetting. A set of beliefs. Like I know, you know, I got all the answers. Confidence that everything will work out okay. But that's not really what it is. So I like to think real functional in the moment equanimity isn't rational. Really has nothing to do with the future, nothing to do with how likely we think anything is going to work out, nothing to do with like, well, this is actually okay. It's not rational. It's more of like it's more physical than mental, but it's certainly like a whole being response, a calm, centered way of being with whatever conditional turbulence we're facing, because that is like, that's the best way to be. That is best place from which we can respond. The wisest, most compassionate, most effective way. Letting go of stories, anticipation, embodiment, trust, surrendering an ego-based sense of control, allowing something to move through us. One of my most transformative experiences of this was in Aikido, where this is exactly what we were seeking to do when we were doing Aikido, was to be, even if somebody was coming to attack you, you weren't anticipating, you weren't like conflicting, you weren't like, I want to get you. You tried to remain as absolutely still as possible and allow a response to arise. It's like getting out of the way. I'm kind of really skeptical. I feel like I'm, if I was one of Jesus's disciples, I would be the doubting Thomas and be like, I don't know. I got to stick my finger in your wounds so that I know it's real. It's like, to me, I got a sense of all of this in Zen, but until I really felt it in Aikido and like, here I would do an exercise and I'd be, one of the classics is that you have a staff, and then somebody else is standing in front of you and they have a staff, and they jut the staff out like this, and they're at 90 degrees to you. So you try to hit the staff. And if you try to hit the staff, you can't hit the staff. It's just, that's what reaction times, right? Like as soon as the person moves and you have a delay, and then your staff always misses their staff, right? I mean, maybe some amazing athletes would have a fast enough reaction time, but for the most part, you just always miss the staff. But if you do, as we said, coordinate mind and body, and don't try, you just hit the staff every single time. And that just like sends shivers down my spine, even to describe it. And I think all of us in our various experiences, feel this. Various things that we do where we're able to momentarily just kind of get out of the way and allow something to arise. Music or dance or art or rock climbing or responses to, you know, loved ones in difficult situations or whatever, when we, and it's almost like, dang, how did that happen? You know, that's, we know this experience. And this is not denial, because we're not shrinking away from anything. It's not indifference. We're not trying to avoid emotional or pain. We're just wholeheartedly showing up, but showing up with like a kind of a fierce determination as well. There's a real presence to it. So it's not passivity. I think, you know, for myself, I've resisted allowing practice to give me equanimity because I was afraid it would make me less responsive and compassionate to the state of the world. Mm-hmm. Kind of like, I don't want to just go off in happy land and then not care. I would rather be in pain, caring, and then trying to do something about it than off, you know, there. But fortunately, that's not how it is. So when you think about it, the motivation for wise and compassionate action comes from a deeper place than our emotional agitation, right? Our anger or fear or anxiety. So when we are calm like that, the appropriate responses arise. That helps us, equanimity helps us stay strong and enables effective action. So what's been going through my mind a lot lately is keep calm and carry on. You know, it turns out that was a poster during World War II. They were going to put it up in London, which was being bombed on a daily basis. And apparently they didn't really widely distribute this poster, but it reflected, you know, the spirit of the folks who stayed there, who like, and in that context, I think about it as, I mean, that was not like, keep calm and carry on. You know, that was a defiant thing. It was like, we have to win. That is not, anything else is not an option. We don't know if we will, but we have to. And therefore, the best thing to do is to keep calm.
Ellen. Thank you, as always. I am wondering if you have any ideas about how to talk to non-Buddhists about the idea of equanimity, mm-hmm. particularly people right now who are really full of anger. And I've heard myself sort of talking about ideas surrounding equanimity, and then them saying, you know, no, I can't turn away from this. I gotta do it. And I have, you know, some of the vocabulary you use is great. Just like, do you have any ideas about how to kind of communicate this idea without it seeming like something that's not realistic or that we should be doing?
I think, honestly, if I was explaining this to anyone, I think I would use that keep calm and carry on analogy. I mean, that's not the only way to do it, and other people may have ideas, but to me, that's like a just this classic example of like the best response that we can do is not to turn away, but to somehow find a certain degree of calm, which we won't always keep, right? We gain it and we lose it, but aspiring to that, which like I was saying early on, there's even just Accepting equanimity as a aspiration is a big deal. Because I think many of us, I mean, it's either I'm going to just do denial or I guess I have to be upset, right? Like, we don't, that's kind of what we, the only options we see. So the idea that equanimity can be an open and witnessing, but like kind of a defiant, like, keep yourself calm because that's the best way, that's how you're gonna win. Danelli and then Chen.
Well, I've been thinking a lot about equanimity lately because there's a lot of anger and I just feel furious and sad and not equanimous. And I think what I've kind of come to is that the word equanimity, I think it's too big for me. It's like really kind of, when I think about that in a moment of high tension, it just seems unattainable. And so for me, I've been kind of instead just kind of closing my eyes and picturing my wisest self, because there's so many versions of me. And so when I picture that wisest self, and what do I need in this moment, whether to do or process or witness, for some reason, equanimity seems more accessible. So I thought I would share that.
Thank you very much, Jen.
Nobody in my family would say that I'm good at equanimity. It's probably like the thing I'm least good at because I have just a lot of emotions right up at the surface all the time. But I got a glimpse when you were talking about how this can come through practice because I remembered a time when we were at a like big school picnic kind of thing, and my daughter was bitten by a dog. And my husband came up with her in his arms, and well, he moved the paper towel that was bloody, and her lip was like in pieces, you know. And I just felt something come forward, like step forward. And I didn't get upset, which I am getting upset now, but at the time I was like, I had clarity. Like, she needs me to be calm or she'll freak out. You know, she was, maybe she was three. And I just had this, I knew what I had to do. And that didn't come from, it was like something came from deep down and just said, like, the rest of you move over. You know, I've got this, I've got this. And I did that. And I thought, you know, that's happened a couple other times in the context of being a parent. Because like it's like all the rest of the noise just it just goes away for a minute. So I guess maybe what I'm thinking is it feels like courage or, you know, clarity, but it doesn't come from I haven't been feeling that lately watching the news, but maybe that's something I can well, that's what I feel like most of the things that we're talking about with Buddhism and precepts are something that has to come from practice and not from just like you said, trying to do it. So anyway, that's all I got for that.
Thank you for sharing. I think that's a, that experience can be a wonderful like touchstone, I think. You're kind of like, oh yeah, what was that? You were like that because, like I said, that's the most effective way to respond. And you knew that, right? Like, because of the importance of it, you were just like, sweep aside all the other bullshit. I'll deal with that later. And like, just, and yeah, if we can summon that, I think what's what helps me so much is realizing that this is not, it's not a rational thing. Because I think a lot of times we're like trying to figure it out and like, how are we going to fix this? And you know, like of all the terrible things that could happen and you know, trying to get our minds around it, which there's a time and a place for that. But then it's kind of like, well, Chris?
I really enjoyed this talk. I love words. And by the end of the day, or at least by the end of the week, I'm going to try to work Aquinas into one of my casual sentences. The thing that strikes me about the conversation is I think you like created this compelling reason for equanimity in the face of difficult situations. But one of the things that strikes me is that equanimity also has value in the face of ecstasy or joy. And I wonder if you could speak to that value at all.
I guess what first springs to mind is, you know, so equanimity in the face of something unpleasant, you know, is refraining or somehow, you know, not engaging in the like, you know, but equanimity in the face of something like that, we're going to have the opposite response usually with something that is really joyful and wonderful. And how, you know, I don't get out walking in the woods as often as I would like, or camping or whatever. And when I get out there, I'm just like, how do I do this more? I gotta do this more. Like, you know, it's, I don't know, like we're constant, you know, or we get together with friends and it's lovely. And we're just like, how do we do this more? You know, like we gotta do it more. We gotta hang on to it. I don't know. And that always, you know, leads to a dissatisfaction associated with our joy instead of like, yay, this was lovely. And just kind of let it be what it is.
You brought up something that I've been struggling with lately. I have fibromyalgia, so I constantly deal with chronic pain. And recently I've been dealing with the extreme fatigue, and I'm very hyper, which thankfully, because it keeps me going. But lately I can't do anything. I have to lay down and sleep. And then I keep thinking, oh my God, I'm like sleeping my life away. I don't want to sleep my life away. And so what I've had to kind of reframe that and say, I have to, because that's what my body needs. And so when I'm awake, I just have to make the best of my time when I'm awake, because what else am I going to do? Be angry and upset. And yes, I am. I can't stand having to do that. I can't stand. But at the same time, I just said, it is what it is. I will make the most of my awake times. And just accept the fact that I have to sleep sometimes. So.
It's a, you know, it's important that the equanimity includes our emotional responses, right? Like, we are going to get upset. We are going to react. We are going to get fearful or anxious or whatever. And to get upset about getting upset just contributes to the problem, right? So it is what it is. And it's not really, I mean, it's actually just natural. It's not a bad thing to respond in a way that what was it? Now I'm getting all just like, because there's these passages in this book, The Roots of Goodness by Uchiyama Roshi. And was he describing, like, if somebody came up and held a gun to your head, like, hopefully you would be really like freaked out, scared. You know, you just, that would be the natural response. Yeah. Carl.
Yeah, I have lots of thoughts about this. As a young adult, well, I grew up in like a very like reactionary household. So as a young adult, I was just like, I don't get angry, but I wouldn't get sad. I would never like cry or like hardly ever cry. I was just like, it was not like equanimity. It was pushing it down. And now we're practicing equanimity and this is coming up. And all of a sudden I'm like crying all the time. And like this is not right. But it's almost like I'm at peace with the emotions that I'm feeling. Mm-hmm. And that's like, I mean, it's kind of like being fearless and having courage, like Jen had mentioned. And I'm like really sinking into this book that I'm reading, The World Could Be Otherwise by Norman Fisher. I'm reading it again with like a new perspective. Mm-hmm. And one of the, he talks first about very early on about generosity. And he talks about the gift of fearlessness. And I think that's kind of what if we're like talking about courage and everything. I've told a few people already that, but I helped a friend. She had to put her old dog down, and she asked me to be with her and drive her home. And you know, like, okay, I'm gonna be fearless. I'm gonna give the gift of fearlessness to my friend. This is like so important to me to do this for her. And of course, the morning of, I wake up and I'm just immediately crying. I go to New Seasons, I go pick up flowers and my lunch, and I'm just like sitting in the hot food section with these flowers and tissues and sobbing in public. And I'm like, oh God, I'm really messing this up. And I go to her house and I'm just crying. And she's like immediately, she's like doing so much better than me. Like, hurting me. And I'm like, no, this is not. But in a way, it would be so weird if I showed up and was just like not sad. You know, just like giving this fearlessness of like, this is a sad thing that I'm doing with you, and we're both going to be sad together.
Anyway. Yeah. I mean, we could think of it as also like giving the gift of like comfort with who we are, you know, which really helps other people feel that way, you know, if we're just like, I don't know, maybe even we just get like pissed at something and then we'll just be like, oh, sorry, that happens sometimes, you know, just like rather than like kind of being embarrassed and more angry. I mean, I remember being a kid and just thinking like, there's nothing worse than seeing an adult trip. It was so awful and uncomfortable because they would trip and then they'd be kind of like, and like, it's just like, yeah. I mean, it makes it like worse if somebody tripped and was just like, whew, you know, I mean, who cares? I mean, yeah, and I'll have to give the gift of tears. I mean, if any of you ever need me to do a funeral, I would, because like you're saying, like, no, don't comfort me. It's not about me. Like, I don't want to distract from the people who are really mourning, but that's just the way I am. And I'll just be crying with you. For maybe one more. Anybody else? A little less? Jessica.
So to think about whether to ask this question, it's kind of, I think, maybe where the edge of my practice is. So I have moments of actual equanimity, but they sure don't last very long. It's like a moment. Mm-hmm. And I'm also dealing with an injured foot, paradoxically. It's not a stone, but it's, you know, painful, disagreeable, and repellent. And in addition to all the other stuff in the larger world. And what I'm finding is that I have these moments of equanimity and they dissipate very quickly. And then I feel even more cranky and upset by the, you know, the repellent things. And it sort of feels like the Mara within kind of rising up and saying, aha, gotcha, you know? And I just wonder if you have any comments about how to then respond when the equanimity doesn't last, because of course it goes away and things, I don't know, it's a combination of perhaps beating myself up for not maintaining it. And then, I don't know. Yeah.
Oh, that's a great one. That's when, like, it's kind of the paradox of practice, that when we set our intention to do something, you know, to sit zazen, to, you know, cultivate equanimity, it's like, and we immediately cause a problem. We immediately kind of, now we set up a goal and it's either happening or it's not happening, and it complicates things. And yet it's like there's no other way to do it. I mean, you can't shortcut that whole process by saying, well, I won't try to cultivate equanimity. Like, but it is a very like internal journey, where we pay attention to like what opens us up to this way of being, which we know is better and that we prefer. Who what gets in the way? I mean, it's more of like this, if we can kind of stand back as if we were a scientist observing our own being and not care. Right? Like, we care, we want the equanimity, and we do not want the being upset. And it's hard not to, you know, be like that. But if we can step back a little bit and just be like, interesting. So, yeah. So when, and I noticed when you got more sleep, you had several more moments of equanimity, you know, and do you try to hang on to the equanimity? You can really kind of ask your own questions, because usually I think equanimity, like, well, here's my example. Like, so when I was in Aikido, and I'm trying to essentially, like, on demand be in this way, which was very very tricky, right? Because, like, now I'm trying to be this way, and am I being this way? I gotta try to be this way, right? And like, I'm trying really hard, and I was terrible at it. I was just terrible. And my sensei would just like laugh and look at me like, you're just trying to do this with your mind. You're trying to get your mind around it. And he'd come over and he'd go like this, and he'd tap me on the head, and then I would have it. And it was like, if we doubt we have it, then we don't have it. It's like, it's more of like a lack of doubt. We, like zazen and all the other things that we're trying to do, it's almost something that's always there. It's that we overthink it and lose touch with it. Did you have something, Ruth Ann?
Oh, this is so good. Thank you. Equanimity is a word new to me in usage since Zen. And I think of, I attach it to equal. A bird needs two wings to fly. So if we're open to both sorrow and joy, we can be in that space. And just like the directions or sitting, being present, not with a future, no agenda. The airlines for the last at least 90s know that people arrive at the airport angry. So if you watch some of the ground crew needing a reservation, people needing to deal with angry people, they just start with, what do you need right now? What one thing can we do? And I mean, that doesn't deflate someone's anger, but it's a place to start. So I ask myself, Okay, is there any one thing? Pema Chodron says, be willing to let go of any belief system we're hanging on to. This is so good. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ruthann. All right. Abiding in this ephemeral world like a lotus in muddy water, the mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha.
All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, bodhisattvas, mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, maha pravishna paramita.
Thank you.
Keep calm and carry on.